Today my guest is Kasia Mirovsa. Kasia, am I saying your name right?
Yes, it's correct.
It's very Kasia nice Mirovsa. To see you. How are you?
Nice to meet you.
And
perfect.
We met last night.
Yes.
We had a great time. We're here in Sydney, Australia. And I could tell by your accent that you're not from Sydney, Australia. Where are you from?
No, I'm not. So right now I'm based in London. However, probably you can guess by my accent that I'm not British. Originally I'm from Poland, and right now I'm just working in London.
Okay, and for the record, I really like your accent.
Thank you very much.
What do you do in London?
So generally speaking, I'm a consultant, but I work as a requirements person. So in Scrum teams, I act as a product owner. If the project is more in waterfall manner, then I'm business analyst. And in general, I'm just responsible for scope, requirements management, backlogs, and all kind of things connected with the working queue for development team.
Are some of your customers still doing waterfall?
Some do.
Okay. But you're not, you're a big agile proponent of this, what I understand.
Yes, I am. However, some companies simply can't do agile because of the external constraints.
Okay.
Especially the government-related, finance-related companies that were restricted by the law to deliver certain documents or certain timelines just in front, like with the timelines a year ahead or something similar, then being agile is really difficult, if I don't want to say impossible, and also cause a lot of frustration from a development team perspective, because if they ask to actually work in waterfall, but everything is named in agile manner, it just cause some kind of frustrations and disconnect for people.
I can respect that. And also, waterfall, a lot of the world's got away from waterfall for very good reasons.
Yes.
And you're talking about that today at this conference, right? What's your topic?
So today I'm talking about how to defeat feature gluttony, and this is in a nutshell about flexibility.
Feature gluttony.
Yes, okay. Feature gluttony, right. Because our customers usually are carving for more and more features, and sometimes, you know, it's really tempting to actually give them what they want instead of trying to understand their needs and why they actually want this integration with Excel. Why? Maybe we can do it in a simpler way, and this will allow them to simplify their task.
Oh, so you're saying, are you saying that customers don't always know exactly what they need?
Usually, because, you know, those are people like we, and they want to just achieve their goal. And because they don't really know the possibilities of the technology,
okay,
they try to ask for something that they always use, because it's familiar for them.
Okay.
I just give example with the spreadsheets, because a lot of people use spreadsheets for everything. And sometimes I wonder why we even bother developing new tools, because spreadsheets
does
everything.
Does everything, yes.
Exactly.
And if we need more to do more, well, we just put more sheets
Excels.
In there.
Exactly.
I've seen that happen many times. I was a consultant for many years, and
yes,
a lot of companies
yes.
are running on top of Excel.
Yes, and I even seen like integrated distributed Excel, so everything is possible.
Yes.
The question is how reliable this kind of architecture is, and if we can maintain it and support it, because then on top of this also goes like a lot of issues with actually making it secure, making it stable, and making kind of backups, or you know, just in case something went wrong and we just lose one of the Excels, then maybe the other chain will disappear as well. So definitely if we are building software, we need to think about, okay, how to simplify the process, not necessarily by adding Excels.
Okay, so I think the example you're using is it's an example of the customer comes with you what they think is the solution. They've already figured out what technology to use because they've seen this technology before, and that may or may not be the ideal technology for the real underlying problem they're trying to solve.
Exactly.
But, so if I'm the developer or the consultant or whatever, if I'm defining the project, how do I approach that customer? They think they know the answer. They think they know. They just want me to write the code. They've already architected it in their mind.
Yes, indeed. So probably I should answer as the typical consultant. It depends.
That's the standard consultant.
That's standard.
Answer, the SCA.
Exactly. But I think that we can break it down for a few use cases. So first, if the customer is flexible, and we know that the customer is flexible, we can start from actually proposing different solution.
Okay.
If customers are not really willing to hear our thoughts, it's useful to actually present alternatives, like couple of solutions for the issue that we see,
mm-hmm.
and compare with the original solution proposed by customer, and highlight what are the advantages, what are disadvantages, what are the costs, and what is more future-proof. Because also what I noticed, companies usually want something that is future-proof in terms, allows them to grow. If there is a solution that it's working for short period of time and they want to just hit the market and they are really willing to have something quickly, then future-proof is not really the advantage.
Right.
But again, it depends on the context. If we present the alternatives and we know what are the goals of the customers, it's actually easier to select the solution that it's the best. And also this allows to help like build the trust. The big question is how to actually know what are the goals. Because, you know, especially if we have the relationship that it's based on, okay, I'm sending you a document with requirements, it's actually really hard to see what was the real issue and why someone requests something that seems ridiculous. So then again, it's another piece of work from us requesting, okay, can we actually maybe see how our users are working? Because sometimes it's really disconnected, the people who are writing requirements, the business sponsors and actual users that somewhere below that are meant to do the job. Sometimes it's like, okay, those users write the documentation or requirements without knowing a bigger picture. Sometimes people from the top, without actually knowing what the people underneath are doing, writing something.
Sure.
And again, it's disconnected. So it's really good to see the chain and how it's working. So if we can ask for observing or at least allowing us to plug in our nice tools that actually record where the users are clicking or what they're doing on the screen. Again, depends on the technology. I don't want to go deeply because some people are fragile in terms of recording what their users are doing, but some companies are actually willing to...
For privacy concerns, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. Basically, there's a technology that exists that says, you know, where their mouse is going and which parts of the screen they're actually using.
Yeah. Even easier, it's like if we can like sit next to the person and like shadow the person and see, but this is not necessarily allowed if we are, for instance, software vendor. Then this kind of relationship is really difficult to get. If we are internal IT department, it's more feasible, but again, probably someone will say, oh, why developer, instead of writing the code, is sitting with one of our users, right?
You might say that as a waste of time.
You know, everything depends on how we communicate it and how we justify it, but some companies are not willing to invest this time to actually see the needs. But again, we may try.
Communications are the key in all these solutions.
Yeah, that's true. That's definitely true.
So conversations with the end users or with the analysts or with somebody that actually knows the software and is using it.
Exactly. Interesting.
And you talked a little bit about I call scope creep.
Yes.
This is a problem as well, and managing that.
Yes, scope creep itself, it's like right now because everyone tries to be flexible, I think that scope creep doesn't exist anymore.
It
exists in a sense, but because we want to be, you know, because we want to be flexible, we need to adapt and basically everything change in really fast pace around us, right?
Okay.
So what I'm trying to present during my talk, that instead of having predefined roadmap for years ahead, we should be seeing like maybe 3 months or like short period of time that we can actually easily change and adapt according to the things that are changing around us. One of the examples I usually gave, it's like when Apple introduced the fingerprint login. Basically, it revolutionized a logging to, for instance, bank applications. And personally, I changed my bank because another bank allowed me to log in via fingerprint once it was the new OT.
Okay.
Probably if they had like years ahead of roadmap, they wouldn't be able to introduce this kind of feature because they would wait. And
because
actually,
there were other features that
were in
3 years ago, they thought they were more important.
Exactly.
By the time the technology caught up to say
yeah,
fingerprint is feasible.
Yeah. Exactly. And right now, this is standard login functionality for almost for everyone. I think that, yeah.
So I think rather when you say you made this really bold statement that scope creep doesn't exist anymore, I think what you're saying is that now we've redefined what scope is. Instead of being scope being something that we're going to plan out for the next 3 years, it's just a few weeks out. And so we're continually redefining our scope.
Exactly.
And we just accepted, we don't call it scope creep anymore. We just call it the next sprint, the next
iteration or time box or whatever.
What are the features for the next few weeks? Yeah. And we're, or maybe the next few months. It's just we've allowed ourselves, we've given ourselves permission to change scope much more frequently.
Also, it's like maybe not even changing it, because another thing is, if we define something a year ahead and then we change it, okay, that's actually scope creep, because you waste time for defining it. What I'm actually saying is trying to reduce, okay, having idea and the vision about applications is really important, so we should have it always in mind, but detailed requirements written down in any kind of form of documentation, even user stories which are written a year ahead with really detailed requirements, acceptance criteria, actually estimated, groomed, and whatever you are doing with them, and then you want to change them, it's actually a waste of time. I'm trying to communicate is, if we really want to be flexible, instead of planning it in a detailed manner, we can keep it more high level, and when the time is appropriate to actually take this thing and we say, oh, now it's time to develop the fingerprint login, we just start defining, okay, what actually it is, what it means, and how we can build it. This is more different approach to the waterfall when everything is predefined.
Yeah.
And because at the beginning we said that some companies are still obliged to stick to the plans and have actually the plans, then actually I have to say, yes, scope creep exists because we've defined the scope, and then once we are changing it, it's scope creep, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And that can be painful.
Yes, it can.
Especially if it's there's money, always money involved.
Yes, that's
true. You change
true.
Requests, you need to decide who's going to pay for it.
Yeah.
Even acknowledging that it is scope creep sometimes is a challenge.
Yes, that's true. That's definitely true.
This is interesting. Is there anything else that you're covering in your talk that we haven't discussed?
Yes, I think that the last really important thing that we frequently forget is actually not only adding features, but also deleting.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, because what happens, you know, if we're like in the nice, cool company that has like few months old or few years old, we probably don't face this issue of having like really heavy tool with a rich amount of features that are not actually used at all. And you know, if we have them and no one touched them, it means that it's hard to maintain the code. Probably those are old features, so there is like really high probability that we don't have test coverage for them.
Sure. And nobody's using them, so they're not being tested manually either.
Exactly. And sometimes someone by accident try to see, okay, what this thing is doing, and then our application is crashing.
Right.
Performance issue and all this kind of stuff that makes our life more miserable. What I'm actually bringing this example is because I also had experience with working with software which was built before internet protocol actually existed.
Wow.
So it was pretty old, and guess what? We are developing new features on top of it.
Oh, I see. So that's really hard to get.
It is. It is. Yeah, so what happened was like actually never ever we even thought about removing the old features.
Right.
And then we start to thinking, okay, if we just wrote the new version of the feature and we know that our customers are not using it, maybe it would be good to check what will happen if we, you know, just hide it.
Right.
If anyone noticed or not. And then we figured out, okay,
nobody
if we hide it,
if
no one is like complaining, we check what will happen if we remove it in terms of, you know, because sometimes there are dependencies that we cannot foresee, especially with the old code base. We just checked all those things and then just started removing one by one. And it was actually easier to get better performance because of this. So
I like that. It's hard. Yeah. So I'll share a story.
It's not easy.
When I was, I used to be the single developer for this one company. I wrote all the software. And one day my boss came to me and said, we have all these functionality here, all these things under these menus. There's a lot of them we don't use at all. Can you get rid of them? And I was heartbroken.
Yes.
I worked so hard on those. I don't want to get rid of them. Somebody might need them.
Yes.
It wasn't really rational.
Yeah.
It was like, getting rid of some of my children.
Yes,
those
yes,
were my babies.
True. I think that's especially with like in the right now, because we are really fans of, you know, experiments,
yes,
lean startup approach, and sometimes it's really hard to admit that actually our experiment failed, even though we have the old cycle and we see that this feature is not selling, because
right,
with old features, with old software that we don't know who wrote it, and we can basically,
those are easy to get rid of.
It's like easy, yeah, and with especially new things that we were like thinking that this is like, you know, game changer, right?
That was,
and then
that
suddenly
was it.
It's not.
Yeah. I was,
yeah,
as I was writing them, they were,
yeah,
my users will love me for this. This is exactly what they think. That was what I was,
yeah,
thinking in my head.
Yeah.
And then they got to it and they just,
yeah,
that wasn't what they wanted. And
yeah,
there were features that I could have spent my time on that were more,
yeah,
important to them.
Exactly. I think that one more important thing is that as well, we need to remember that in this chain, like user development team, there is also usually other people that are involved in the process, especially if we're a software vendor or software house. Those are marketing people who have their slides. So what happens if we remove something and don't tell them?
Ah, I see. So now they're misleading potentially misleading the customers with old
slides. It's sometimes even worse because they present their slide decks, then they're switching on the demo instance and then suddenly see that, oh my God, the feature I want to present is not there.
Right.
So it's then embarrassing for everyone because basically miscommunication that we were talking
again,
about.
Communication is a key.
Yes, it is, it is. So, you know, when we think and plan about, okay, if we can remove something, we need to take into consideration the broader perspective, not only seeing and tracking if our users are actually using it, but also if someone from our company is not presenting it from time to time to the customers or to anyone else. Or maybe there are screenshots on our website and
sure,
people think that this is actual functionality.
Right.
And if we remove it, then they may be a bit disappointed that they can't see it. So this is the kind of things that we should consider, definitely.
Are you? Do you have an online presence?
Yes, I do.
Tell us about it. How do we find more about Kasia?
So I have my own blog, which is www.mysurnamemyname.eu.
Okay, we'll put that in the show notes.
Yes, yes. I know that pronunciation of my name can be challenging, but it's like mrowcakasia.eu. So feel free to check my website. I also have Twitter account, so feel free to follow me at mrowcakasia.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
Did you say .au?
Yes.
Why .au?
Because, okay, so before I moved to UK, I lived in Poland,
uh-huh,
and I was basically thinking, okay, what kind of domain I can have? If I choose like my PL, it was like, I don't know where I'm going to end up in which country, so maybe this is kind of universal. Yes, so that's why .eu.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, Europe, right?
Oh, EU, I'm sorry. So I thought it said AU, which is Australia. Which
No.
Okay.
Sorry, EU.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kasia, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for the interview. Thank you. Okay, so hello to everyone and to all my friends from the other side of the camera. Hello from the NDC, which is the awesome technology conference. Hopefully see you live somewhere around the world.